Welcome to The Science of Sex, a podcast about the ins and outs of the latest research about everyone's favorite topic. Here's Dr. Jana, an NYU professor of human sexuality, and Joe, a guy who's a fan of sex.
Hey, Dr. Jana.
Hello.
We're going to get kinky on episode 51, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Yeah, we are. I don't know. Why are we talking like this? I don't understand.
Because it's kinky.
It's kinky.
I don't know.
So today's episode is special. It's the first time in our 51 episode history. We're going to be talking about pup play today, right?
Pup play indeed.
And I didn't really know what pup play was. I mean, I guess just hanging out with you for quite a while, I could probably put 2 + 2 together. Mm-hmm. But it's exactly what it sounds like, right?
Yes, it's people acting like puppies.
Yeah.
And playing around in both sexual and non-sexual sometimes ways. And we have Dr. Liam Wignall on the show from the UK who's going to talk to us about his research on biopups.
That's biopups?
Yeah.
That's the correct term?
All
right, cool. All right, well, now I understand you have a couple appearances coming up. Are you going to discuss pup play in any of your... any of your future installations of appearances or no?
I don't think I'll be talking about pups and pup play in my upcoming appearances, but I will be talking about a lot of different things because I have two events coming up and before the end of the year.
Okay.
One is on December 6th at the Assemblage, and it's called Doctor's Orders, where it's me and three other doctors answering life's big questions.
Right. And you're not going to, and I joked with you last week about like what questions you will answer. Like I can't ask you about how should we handle the influenza outbreak. You won't handle those kind of questions, right?
No, and those are not life's big questions.
Oh, come on.
No, Joe.
All right.
We're going to answer questions that are relevant to all four of us, and we all have something to say that comes from a different perspective so that you can have a more complete and holistic idea of how to approach these life's big questions. And the good news is it's free. It's open to the public, so anybody could come for no money whatsoever. So all you have to do is RSVP. So you go to theassemblage.com and go to their events, and you can RSVP for this one. And the other event is on December 11th at the V Club, which is this kind of space for sex and relationship classes and coaching for women. And Dr. Justin Lehmiller, who you remember, he's one of our first two-timers on the show, the author of What's Your Sexual Fantasy.
He's a big sex science superstar.
He is a big sex science superstar. Yeah. And him and I are going to be doing a joint talk, workshop, presentation, whatever you want to call it, on gender differences in sex. So, you know, are women and men different, and how different and how similar are they? So I think it's going to be a fabulous talk. So come on all.
And how do you get tickets to that one?
It's on the vclub.com on their events. And there will be, for both of these events, obviously, there will be links to them on our episode page on the scienceofsexpodcast.com.
All right. So a couple appearances you mentioned. Nothing about puppy play. So you're going to have to tell me about today's guest and what since you're not going to do any puppy play stuff in the future. Talk about puppy play today. What you got?
Well, I'm not going to tell you too much about puppy play because we have an expert on pup play, the first one who's ever published anything in the academic literature on this particular kink or interest or whatever you want to call it. And that's Dr. Liam Wignall, who's a lecturer in psychology at Bournemouth University in the UK and a member of the Research Center for Behavior Change. He's a qualitative psychologist who studies kink subcultures, sexual identities, and virtual media from an interdisciplinary perspective. He received his PhD from the University of Sunderland, where he researched individuals who engage in kink activities but differ in levels of immersion into the kink communities. He's interested in social change and sexualities more generally and is currently working on a project on drag performers' experiences of LGBT cultures. Dr. Liam Wignall, welcome to the Science of Sex podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm super excited to have you because we, even though we've talked about some BDSM stuff in the past on the show, we haven't really delved deep into any one given fetish, have we, Joe?
No, we've covered the gamut of the BDSM game. Yeah,
right. But we've talked about it more generally. We haven't looked at one specific thing and really dive deep.
No, okay, we have not. I agree with that. The limb, she's doing these hand signals, so I didn't know what she meant by that. So she's using
deep.
A fist deep. Okay, all right, go ahead.
Just deep.
Okay, got it.
So we're gonna do that today.
Okay, I'm ready.
Good. You know, Joe can get shocked pretty easily. So let's see how he fares today.
It should be interesting.
Thanks, Liam.
So we're going to talk about pup play. And what we usually like to start our conversations with is just ask our researchers how the heck they end up studying what they're studying. So how did you end up studying pup play?
So I basically stumbled into research in this area. I did my PhD on kinky sexual subcultures and virtual leisure spaces, interviewing people across the UK who immerse themselves to different levels in kink communities. And in the early stages of these interviews, this activity kept coming up time and time again. They'd mention pup play to me or engaging with other pups. And I had to take a step back and say, what is pup play? The first thing I did was go to Google Scholar, type it in, nothing came up. So I thought, I've found my niche. I'm going to do my own study and start research. I started speaking to some of the participants and asked them, where can I come across these individuals? Through snowball sampling, kind of introducing me to other people. They told me about the pups, but also told me to go to Twitter and speak to the pups on there, which I was fascinated by, the idea that all these pups were on Twitter and I'd not come across them before.
Yeah, one of your papers is on pup Twitter, so I'm definitely going to ask about that to tell us a little more about what we can expect from Twitter.
And Liam has been throwing the word pup around consistently.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
We should try to get into what pup is, because he's making it sound like water or air. Can we get a little more descriptive on what pup is?
Of course. That's what we're going to talk about all day today, Joe.
Okay, let's get pupping.
I'm surprised you haven't come across it before. Like, it's such a common thing.
Oh, yeah, really?
Yeah, it's so common. So in the broadest terms, pup play is a kink and a form of role play where individuals take on animalistic qualities that you would associate with young dogs. They engage in tactile behaviors such as nuzzling up to people, engaging in cuddling behaviors, licking, and some more playful behaviors such as barking, biting, scratching, licking, nuzzling. That's the basic definition of it. So some of the pups would engage in fetch behaviors. They would engage in, say, a pup mosh, where you have pups all around in a circle interacting with each other, passing a ball amongst each other. And then you get pups who would engage in sexual behaviors.
With other pups? Is it a pup-on-pup play?
Pups would engage in sexual behaviors, or can engage in sexual behaviors, with both handlers and with other pups. It was dependent on the relationship between the pup and the handler, and between the two pups. But yeah, they'd have sex with anyone that they wanted to, providing it was consensual.
Is the sex that they were having different with the owners or handlers versus the pups, the other pups?
Yes, there were differences between them. With the pup and handler kind of sexual relationship, it would more be kind of, there'd be more clear guidelines around submission and domination. More often than not, the pup would be in a receiving role of anal penetration, on the giving end of oral sex. They would be the person who'd be spanked or be flogged, etc. Mm-hmm. Whereas within a pup environment with kind of sex between pups, it was a lot more fluid. There were pups would change position based on their kind of preferences. They would do a wide range of different other sexual slash kink.
So when it's pup on pup play, one of the pups could then be a dom pup, right?
Yeah, there's different terminology within the pup world, I suppose. Dom might be one label that they get that would be used. More often than not, they may use the term alpha and omega, beta, and there seems to be kind of a hierarchy amongst pups, with the two common ones being an alpha pup who is submissive to handlers and kind of other dominant top individuals. But within the pup community, they're the top dog, so to speak. I didn't even realize that was going to be a pun until I said it.
That's a great pun. It works
thank
well.
Thank you.
I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of dog puns in this episode. I just have a feeling.
Oh my God, the pup community is awful for dog puns. If they can get a pawsome pun in, they will.
Sounds like, Liam, you've deep dived into all the puns too. You got them all.
I know them, and kind of for my sins, I have to interact with them, but it does make me cringe slightly.
And you also talk about special gear that is often a part of this play?
Some of the participants I spoke to discussed a pup uniform and all kind of the bare minimum essentials that are needed to engage in pup play. And that was more commonly a pup hood and some protective equipment, because when you engage in pup play, you're normally down on all fours. It can be detrimental to your knees. It can kind of hurt your hands when you do it as well. So they normally say knee pads to protect the knees, and then they may put gloves to protect the arms, because it's a lot of weight pressure to put on your hands and knees over a significant period of time. They also have a pup hood or a pup mask, and there's various different types of these which allow the pup to remain anonymous. It helps them to get into a pup headspace, and it helps others to interact with them better, They are more likely to be approached like a dog because they have this kind of dog pup face, if that makes sense.
Right. I mean, they're more dog-like because of that.
And the mask, I just Googled, and Etsy apparently is huge on pup play. There's a bunch of homemade ones that go for like anywhere of like $200 to $300 US, and they're very elaborate. Like it gives the appearance of the face to look like a dog.
That's the point. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
And I can imagine a leash and a collar as well.
Yeah. So on top of kind of the puppy uniform, and I kind of hate calling it that because you can come across pups who have a whole host of other gear that they will wear when they're engaging in pup play. They will wear collars, leashes. They can do engage in pup play alongside other kinks. So they may wear a lycra singlet, they may wear a rubber singlet, top, shorts, they can wear leather alongside it, and it kind of pup play interact with other kinks and fetishes. Mm. I suppose the one thing that I've just realized I'm missing, but is one of the more common things, is a pup tail.
When
you see the pups walking around on all fours, they often have a tail coming out of their backside, their bum. Sometimes it's inserted, sometimes it is worn on the outside of a belt, but a hood and a tail and protective gear are kind of the common things that you see.
I don't know if it's just a generational thing, Doc, but I don't know if you've probably noticed in the UK as well, like people just enjoy dressing up. You know, the whole Comic-Con cosplay experience, I think this sort of feeds into it. It's sort of like make-believe where you can, you know, some people dress up as Superman or Batman, and then some people want to dress up as a puppy. There's some sort of fascination with dress-up, I guess.
Yes, basically. I was reading an article online written by a pup about why they engage in pup play, and they just kind of listed all the things associated with dressing up, that you can pretend to be someone else for a little bit, you get interacted with differently based on what you're wearing, etc. There's something about exploring one's own identity and other identities through dressing up. It also relates to play more broadly. When you mention dressing up, you know, you often see children dressing up as superheroes and kind of just engaging in these fun behaviors where you can pretend to be in a different world, you can pretend to have superpowers, all these different things. It's fun. Exactly the same for people who dress up as pups. It's a fun activity more than anything. I might kind of state that there's social, sexual and relaxation things, but the broad thing about the motivation for pup play and dressing up as a pup is that it's fun.
But there's also a sexual component to that, as opposed to just, you know, kids dressing up as Superman.
Or adults dressing up as Superman.
Or adults dressing up as Superman who are not trying to pretend they're Superman while having sex, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose kids may not do that.
Right.
As you said, Joe, adults may dress up as Superman and engage in that form of role play. You think of doctors and nurses, cops and robbers, teacher and students. You engage in that role play in that sexual environment, and it's fun. You stay in that character. It might feel a bit weird at first, but if you get into that character, and you know, I'm only thinking of a teacher and discipline now, but there's ways in which you can make that role work for you. There's ways that the pups have found, actually, pup play is something I enjoy engaging in, and it's something I can do as a sexual activity as well.
Yeah, I think the relationship to role play makes perfect sense to me. And I think what kind of throws off a lot of people about these specific animal role play scenarios. So it's not only pup play, right? Some people will do this, the same thing only for other animals like horses or cats or something like that. I don't know if they have the special like horse play or cat play. Or
There's a website called Rough Stuff, which have started creating kitten masks. There aren't many kittens or cats that I've come across into kitten play. I know pony play, as it's called, is a lot more popularity and attention around that compared to kitten play. It's been featured in documentaries that I've seen. The difference between the different types of animal play is that you get different things out of it. And that relates to the animal. When you think of a pup, you think of a young, energetic, happy to see you, full of love, and kind of always there to give you attention. Mm-hmm. You think of a cat, that is someone who's going to ignore you, who is going to get what they want, who is going to...
They're independent, yeah.
And then you have ponies. That is an animal that is ridden, mm-hmm. is you kind of they... Sounds horrible,
work.
But they have a service. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more fear involved in pony play. And pony play, from what I've seen and the participants that I've spoken to, kind of when they've told me about these other things, pony play is predominantly about riding. Kitten play doesn't have the same level of interaction. Pup play is the popular one, which makes sense because pups are the best animal.
Are they now? Tell us what you really think about all these animals.
Careful, all our cat fans are going to get mad at us, Doc. Be careful.
That totally makes sense to me, and that people would be drawn to these different animals, different types of play, depending on what the personality of these animals we perceive to be and how we interact as humans with these animals. I think what throws off a lot of people specifically about these animal plays, so pony, kitten, pup play, is that it looks kind of like sex with animals or interest in sex with animals, like zoophilia or bestiality. And I know that you kind of talk to your participants about how they feel about this and what are your thoughts about how this kind of play or interest in this kind of play might relate to some sort of interest in sexual interaction with actual animals.
That was one of the things that I thought about when I was conducting these interviews. I didn't know anything about the activity and I wanted to find out as much as possible. So it was absolutely a question that I asked all my participants, what is the relationship between pup play and zoophilia? All the participants I interviewed said that there was no relationship between having sex with animals and engaging in pup play. A minority of them said that they can understand that link, but the key difference is there are no real animals involved. This is about role play. The individuals who engage in pup play recognize that they're humans acting like ducks and that they can come out of this mindset that, you know, once they stand up, once the session is over, they're a human again. Oh, sorry. They've always been a human.
They've all transformed because of pup play into actual dogs.
Yeah.
He's kidding.
Yeah. I mean, once the mask goes on, they find it a lot easier to get into a different headspace. And I suppose transform is a good way of thinking about it mentally. But in terms of their body, they're still a human. They are not having sex with dogs, at least the participants that I interviewed.
So these participants that you talked about and, you know, that you talked about the transformation, do some stay for a finite amount of time in their pup, I guess, persona? I mean, are they a pup for a few hours? Are they a pup for an entire day?
Yeah.
What's pup time? You know, like, you know, dog years. Is there a pup time in terms of how long these folks enjoy this?
It ranges. For some, pup play is a 24/7 activity. They have friendships that know about their engagement in pup play. They wear a tag all the time with their pup name on it. And actually, they may only answer to their pup name. Others, it's very much situational. They'll engage in the activity there and then within a particular setting, particular person. And then after that scene, session, it's done. Then you have kind of people who are somewhere in the middle. They may wear the tag all the time because there's a symbolic connection to other pups that they know or their handler or kind of just a symbolic connection to their pup identity. But for the majority of the time, they're just in non-pup mode. The people who are kind of more towards the 24/7 side of things, there was sometimes in interviews where I was speaking to participants and they may bark now and again. They may kind of cock their heads, as in, you know, when you see a young dog kind of looking sad, wanting food, they do them kind of expressions.
Joey's totally trying to make that.
Yeah, because Dr. Shan is not a dog lover, so I'm showing her how dogs move.
Thank you.
He's I was very close to kind of doing it myself and then making the noise that I associated with dogs, but I was like, no, don't do the example.
Hey, Doc, so then I think you mentioned about the name tags. So the name tags say their pup name and their owner. Is that symbolized in the tag as well?
It completely depends. If they have an owner and if the handler bought them the tag, it may say pup Yappy, for example, and owned by whoever it's owned by. Others will just have their pup name on it. It completely depends on whether that pup has an owner, has a handler, the level of independence they want, and kind of if they're a strong, independent pup who don't need no handler, they'll buy their own tag and have their own name on it.
That's great.
Are they called straight pups, the ones who don't have an owner?
Oh.
Is that very sad?
That term has been used, but I don't think of them like that, because that implies that they're all looking for a handler.
Right.
Some aren't. Mm-hmm. Some enjoy being a pup without the rules and the, you know, the boundaries kind of which are instilled from a handler or a master. Pups are playful by nature.
Mm-hmm. They're like Dr. Jana pups. You are describing a pup that is embodied in Dr. Jana. She doesn't have a master. She doesn't need to be attached to just one other pup or one other handler because she's independent like that.
I would not really call myself a pup.
No, but I'm just saying.
In terms of the independence, yes. Me and the independent pups would be
I wouldn't call you a stray.
I don't think of myself as a stray. How about furries? We mentioned zoophilia, but there's another community that and Joe kind of mentioned with some of these role playing cosplay, mm-hmm. and there is a big community of furries. And how does that relate or not relate to the pup play and other animal play?
Yeah, I see where you're coming from with that question, and I thought the exact same thing, that there seems to be a lot of common features between them. So again, I asked my participants, what are the differences between them? What are the similarities? Are they the same thing? And they were clear to distinguish the differences between pup play and fairy play. And I think it's for some of the participants who were both pups and fairies, they were able to kind of more articulately describe the differences. Pup play is an activity thing where they engage in the behaviors that I described. Fairy play is more about an attachment to a persona, to an alternative personality. I'm not an expert on fairy play. I've read the papers around it. And even then, I still kind of, until I do the same study where I interview 30 participants on what fairy play is, I can't give a really good description of what fairy play is. It is different. There is more focus on the identity for fairies, more focus on the fandom, on the artwork associated with it.
And also the aesthetic is very different, right? It's all about the furry costumes, whereas in pup play, I don't hear or see at all any of the furriness of it. Even though you could think of a dog as, you know, having some fur.
Yeah.
But in all of the pup play, that just doesn't seem to be a part of that at all.
Yeah, and I suppose that partly comes down to the outfits, that the puppets, you can only do so much customization to it. With fairy play, you can have a pup dragon hybrid. You can have someone who their persona is a phoenix, another one who their persona is, I don't know, a hamster or a rabbit.
Right.
There's a lot more flexibility in what you look like, how you identify within the fairy community. I know there's a level of, I can't think of the word, contentiousness such between fairies and pups. At fairy cons, there's more regulations of pups and their gear and what they can and can't wear than there is in relation to fairies. Some of the debates around social versus sexual that the fairies go into, where you get a really strong argument that no, fairy is about the social side of things. There's kids at this fair con and this event. It's absolutely about the artwork. It's about expression of identities.
They try to keep the sexual aspect out of the furry cons.
Yeah, but actually, if you go to Twitter and you look up some fairies, there's a whole host of artwork that is pretty sexual as well. They tend to downplay the sexual in favor of the social. And that same trend has happened for the pubs as well. And I think that's part of that argument is around the legitimization of it. And through desexualization, they're able to say, look, we're not that bad. Right. Which absolutely doesn't relate to what I found and my experiences conducting this research. There's absolutely a social and a sexual side of pub play and fairy play.
And it might be that obviously there are some furries, as there might be some pups, who are not particularly interested in the sexual or at all interested in the sexual component of it. And it's all social and identity. But there's clearly at least a large minority, if not a majority, of both of these who are involved and interested in the sexual aspect of it, no?
Absolutely. The majority of the participants I interviewed recognized pub play as being a social and a sexual activity. I think it was 4 out of 30 said that for them it was always sexual and they couldn't understand the social side of things. Whereas for 9, I think, maybe don't quote me, they said actually pub play is not a sexual activity. It's always social for us. Real dogs don't have sex, neither do we.
What?
They focus more on the tactile behaviors and on the community aspect of it rather than the sexual.
Right.
So the key word is, I think Dr. Shana's eyes for the first time was kind of spinning a little bit, because it's the key is pup play. Basically, you're a baby dog as opposed to being a large dog when you're getting it
on.
Dogs
definitely have sex. Pups may not.
Pups are like playing in the ground. Yeah, okay. They're twirling around. Okay,
right,
cool.
Right, gotcha. Now, you interviewed exclusively gay and bisexual men for this paper and for your pup Twitter paper. Any particular reason why? Is this only a bi gay male phenomenon? Are there straight men and women of any orientation out there who are engaging in pup play? What do we know about pup play outside of gay male communities?
Part of the reason why I interviewed 30 gay and bisexual men was because they were the participants that I had access to. My PhD was on gay and bisexual men who engage in kink. So they were the participants that was the community that I was able to get participants of. Since the explosion of popularity of pub play, I've come across pub play within straight communities. I've come across females who engage in pub play, queer individuals, individuals who don't identify, trans individuals who engage in pub play. There's a whole host of individuals who engage in it. My experience and my understanding is that it is predominantly something done within gay and bisexual kink subcultures. But I'm absolutely aware that that is partly down to my bias and who I interact with and the communities that I research.
How and why do people get into, I guess we talked a little bit about the why already and what it does for them. How do people get into this? Is this something that you sort of fantasize from an early age somehow and then you end up doing it? Or do you have to see it and get introduced? You said the popularity of it increased lately. So my guess is there's some level of people learning about this lifestyle and then getting into it. What did you find? How did people get into this?
Yeah, you're right that it's more a case of you see it and then you start to think, oh, that looks like something I might want to engage in. The online played a massive role for introducing my participants into pub play. Specifically, Tumblr was a very big thing for the participants. The common narrative or the common story of how do I get involved, how did you get involved in pub play, was they would do exploration online of their other kink interests. So for example, if they were exploring submission and domination, they would go onto Tumblr or go onto various porn websites and come across pub play. They would come across various pictures of it, potentially a few videos, whether they're sexual or not, but videos that would involve a level of submission and domination. The Tumblr famous pups would have details on how you could message them on Twitter or on their kink profiles. The people who were then kind of exploring pub play and wanting to find out more would message them and get more information about it. What I've started to see more recently is people would go to events and come across pubs there. So they may have, you know, they're getting introduced to the kink scene more generally and go to an event and think, oh, I'm going to see what's out there. And they come across a whole host of fetishes, kinks, etc., and pub play would be one of them.
Right.
There are events kind of full fetish in London, for example, which has a separate section dedicated to pups. You more common now, you go to an event and you're going to come across pup play. And that is one way that you can get introduced to it.
Were your participants interested in other forms of kink as well? Or was this kind of an isolated interest that they had?
They were definitely interested in other kink. And that was kind of one of the beautiful things about pup play is how easily it can interact with other kinks. As I said, when you're wearing gear, if you're into leather, you can do pup play in leather. Right. If you're into water sports, you can do pup play in water sports. If you're into a whole host of other activities, you can do them with pup play. One of the things that more recently pup play is being used as is a tool to explore other kinks. So when you're in this pup play headspace or pup mode, you can be very playful and very cheeky to the other people that you're playing with. Mm. If you don't really want to do something, you just bark and walk away. Mm. You can explore what you like, what you don't like. And it's certainly a narrative. I don't know how strong it is, but people have used pub play to find out what else they're into and then left pub play behind and said, okay, I'm into these different things. Right. Because in the past, to engage in particular kink activities, because of the stigma, because of the underground nature of it, you had to kind of immerse yourself quite heavily to be able to get in a position where you could explore these activities. Now, with the internet, with various events across the world, you can turn up, engage in an activity, see if you like it, see if you don't, and then move on.
Right.
Pub play is used as something in which you can do that. You can go up to a handler, whether it's through barks or a conversation beforehand, say, these are the kind of things that I want to engage in. If I don't like it, I'm going to just bark. I'm just going to say, no, thank you, I've changed my mind, and walk away.
Dr. Shana didn't ask, what were the ages of these participants? Like, I was curious, because you said, was it 40 participants?
30.
Of the 30, what were the age ranges?
So, ballpark, like 18 to 25. The oldest participant I interviewed was 35, and he'd been engaging in pub play for 16 years.
Wow, okay.
So that was kind of one of the participants who was doing pub play before they realized it was pub play.
Right.
Interestingly, that participant, his type of pub play changed. At the start, he was very energetic, hyper pop, whereas as he got older and getting down on all fours became a bit harder, he moved towards a lounge dog where he'd bark, he'd take the strokes, he'd take the affection and all the different treats, but he wouldn't play fetch.
That's funny. I mean, yeah, dogs do change over their lifespan, so why wouldn't humans, pups?
Yeah,
biopups.
You see some of the dogs, sometimes they get so old, the owner has to carry them around. They just can't walk around anymore, and that could happen in puppy play. Some of these may just have to be carried around.
In one of the interviews, there was one of the participants said to me they knew of somebody who'd been engaging in pup play that long without protective gear, that they suffered damage to their knees, which is kind of, I don't know how true that story is, but it really does emphasize the importance of the protective gear with pup play. And I think that kind of solidifies it more into being a kink activity, because within kink more generally, we absolutely promote safe activities as much as we can, promote the use of protective gear and engage in activities in a way that minimizes harm to the individual.
Right, right. Now, you've mentioned pup headspace several times, and I don't know to what extent listeners are familiar with the whole idea of headspace, which is a pretty common thing in the kink BDSM world. But let's just talk a little bit about what headspace is, and pup headspace specifically, and what role it plays in the whole pup play.
The easiest way to understand what the headspace is to apply it to a different activity. If we think about yoga, where you kind of engage in a form of mindfulness and you concentrate on your body, on your movements, you try to forget about the outside world and you just completely immerse yourself in the activity, that's a form of headspace. Same for a long distance runner who describes getting in the zone. When they kind of reach a point, they just forget they're running. They can't remember how long they're doing, any music they've got on, they can't hear. They're just completely focused on the activity. It's exactly the same for the headspace within pup play. They focus on the activity, their thinking becomes very instinctual, And we say they see a ball, they want the ball, they get the ball, they've got the ball. There's no complications of whose ball is that, what are the social norms around getting that ball. They just do what they want. They don't lose their kind of broader social norms of, actually, I'm not going to do anything consensual, but they become kind of just focused on the activity. It's very, very common, or it's more common and well-documented within kink more generally, where you experience a level of euphoria because of the endorphins released when engaging in the activities, because of the adrenaline, and you almost feel a level of kind of come down after it, where you kind of have to take a moment to get back into the room to think, what was I doing, but okay, I'm, you know, not engaging in this activity anymore. I need to be aware again. It's an alternative mindset, I suppose, related to mindfulness.
And flow, being in flow, right? I think we've been talking a lot lately in psychology, just more in general, about any activities, about the importance kind of being fully immersed in an activity and not really thinking or realizing or even noticing what's happening around you. And so this is just the specific version of being in flow in this context.
Yeah, absolutely. And we applied Csikszentmihalyi's flow onto pub play to see, is that kind of the same thing? Mm-hmm. And it was. I suppose there also within psychology, there's this buzz, and more generally, around mindfulness. So Right. Flow, mindfulness.
Most people would have had no idea, Joe included, what you meant or what even those sounds were when you said Csikszentmihalyi. Michał Csikszentmihalyi is the psychologist who was the first one to really start talking and doing research on flow generally in psychology. And so they, Liam was saying is that they applied kind of that framework to see if it applies to the pub play, and it did.
One of the things that all pubs stress to me, minus, you know, a small minority, it is so hard to get into that pub space or pub head space, pub mindset. And not all of them could reach it as much as they tried. But, you know, the very lucky few, it was a case of putting on the hood, putting on the mask, and it was straight away they were into that pub head space. Whereas for the majority, it takes practice to get into it. It doesn't always come when they want it to. And they may have to be engaging in the activity for a substantial period of time, which again is very reminiscent of flow, of mindfulness, etc. It takes practice.
Last question before we let you go. What's up with pup Twitter? You have another paper. We mentioned it earlier on pup Twitter. We didn't get to talk about it much, but give us like the 2-minute description of what pup Twitter is and what one could expect if they looked for, is it a hashtag?
It depends what you're looking for. So pup Twitter is an example of a social networking site being used by a kink subculture. So it's a accessible way for pups to create a profile which has a picture of them in pup gear. They have their basic information about themselves, i.e. their age, their sexuality, where they're from, maybe their pup name. So they'll have these profiles, which they can then interact with other pups on it. They can share pictures. While they may use it in the same way that we may use Facebook and Twitter, they have their own pup spin on it. So they'll tweet about particular pup events, about sex events that might be related to pup play, around a news article or a YouTube video or a documentary that comes out related to pup play. They'll have a global conversation amongst all the pups. And it's becoming an easy way to A, join the pup community more generally and interact with other pups, find resources, find images, and find kind of more links to how do I find more information out about this. And it's just a generally welcoming place where pups can explore the community. It also benefits from the features of Twitter, such as sharing pictures, sharing videos. And as I said, pups like their puns. They enjoy the feature of using Twitter GIFs to react to one another.
Nice.
It mirrors what the pups do offline. They use it socially to interact with one another. They use it sexually to flirt, to share images, and they use it to engage in offline meets. So they may private message and say, you know, let's meet up, let's have a coffee, etc.
Amazing. Joe, did you learn a lot about...
I learned almost way too much.
Way too much? About puppy play. I mean, you looked up all the gear and everything. Did you order anything already?
I have to be careful if anyone looks at my search history, because there's going to be some freaky shit going down.
You never know. Your partner might be into it. Most people got into it because they got exposed to it, because they saw someone else doing it. So, you know... You might be one of those
people. This podcast could be the gateway to pup play?
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, anything is possible, Dr. John. If you've learned anything in the last year and a half with me, you know, you got to keep your mind open to things.
Exactly. Dr. Liam Wignall, thank you so much for being on the Science of Sex podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, that was pretty cool. A lot of information about pup play there, Dr. Jana.
Indeed.
And I did Google a lot of things, and I did... delve into a lot of kink stores that I had no idea
existed.
Hopefully my corporation that owns this podcast doesn't search any kind of like IP tracking or anything like that and finds out what I'm looking at.
You think you're going to get in trouble for looking up pup play gear?
I don't know. You know, one thing I will not get in trouble for, Dr. John, is one, you know, it's one of my pages that we peruse every week. It's laylow.com. So hopefully that one's okay.
Smooth. That's a very smooth transition into talking about our sponsor.
I'm trying. Doing my best, Dr. Jana.
Oh, Joe. But thank you for bringing Laylow up. Yes.
There is no tab on laylow.com for pup play.
But there are a lot of different items that you could get at laylow.com for 20% off with our discount code SCIENCE.
Dr. Jana, we have mentioned a bunch of your favorites on there. And if you do go to laylow.com, there's a ton on there.
There are a lot of options,
So is there another one that maybe as someone's listening to this podcast and they'll log on to laylow.com, what can they plop in there on the search bar there and see? Like, hey, let me try this one.
I have one for you. And actually, this is really funny. I thought more about this toy because I did something last week that I've never done before in terms of sex education. I did sex education at a bachelorette party.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. At a bachelorette party, they wanted to start it off with having me go there and answer some of the questions about sexuality that they've had. And they wanted to see a bunch of toys to kind of get acquainted with a lot of toys. And one of the most popular ones that all the ladies were into, and, you know, obviously there was the bride-to-be, but most of her friends were already in long-term relationships, married and all that, was this couple vibrator. And the Laylow version of the couple's vibrator is called the Tiani.
Okay.
T-I-A-N-I. And that's basically a double vibrator that can go inside the vagina, has one vibrator, one motor that will hit the G-spot and one that will go around the clit, and it's hands-free. It can stay in while you're having intercourse.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's really cool. And sure, it's not going to work for everybody. I mean, you know, nothing works for everybody, depending on the position that you're using it in, depending on, you know, your size and your exact shape and the shape of the penis that is going in and all that. But for many people in many positions, this can work quite well so that you get vibration on both the clitoris and the G-spot without hands, without holding anything, while the penis is going in and out.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So pretty cool stuff.
Now I see it's a two-part thing. Is there like a remote control? Is that?
Yeah. So the later versions of that have a remote control. So yes, you can actually control it while having sex. I mean, obviously you don't need to be touching it. You can touch the remote control and tell it what you want it to do, faster, slower, whether you want a different rhythm, a different pattern of vibration, and so on. So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Cool.
It's a pretty cool couples vibrator.
All right. That is the Tiani, T-I-A-N-I, and it's available at laylow.com. It's one of Dr. Jana's favorites. It's good for couples.
Good for couples.
And that wraps up episode number 51. Who we got scheduled next week on the program?
Oh, next week we have someone who teaches at NYU in the same department where I teach, and his name is Pascal Wallisch, and he's going to talk to us about professors' attractiveness levels versus their evaluations, like whether how hot professors are perceived to be is correlated with their evaluations as a professor. And now, whether that differs for men and women.
Is this just your opportunity to tell you how hot your students think you are? Is this all
this is not about me at all.
And is this guy going to come in here and say, by the way, Dr. Jana just scored off the charts. All her students were just so attractive. Is this what's going to be next week?
No, I promise there will be nothing about Dr. Jana's level of attractiveness or evaluation as a professor.
Okay, all right. Good.
Okay,
you're good with having... All right. No one rated you in this study, but if you want to rate the podcast,
nice.
You can. can, if you listen to us via the Apple iTunes Store or any other player, make sure you rate and review. Let us know what you think. Give us a few stars. Drop us a review. Tell a friend.
Yes.
You know, there's nothing.
Friend. There's more the merrier. Sharing is caring.
There's nothing I like better when someone tags us on like Instagram or Twitter and say, I found this new awesome podcast.
Yes, you should listen to it too. And if you have any questions that you would like us to answer on our next Sex Question Palooza, please write to us at info@scienceofsexpodcast.com or on any of our social media, and we'll get that on the list.
Dr. Jenna, by the way, you are attractive, so don't worry.
I was really starting to doubt that, and my self-esteem was wavering.
I didn't want to end on a low note, so because we had that whole back and forth
You're cute too, Joe.
Just cute.
For your age. You're pretty good looking for your age.
Cute, really?
Bye.
All right, bye.
To connect with Dr. Jenna and Joe, go to thescienceofsexpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter @scienceofsexpod and follow us on Facebook @the Science of Sex Podcast. Subscribe now to listen to the weekly podcast.